It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, changes to the GED high school equivalency exam led to a big drop in the number of people taking it and passing it. We'll find out about an innovative program in southeastern Wisconsin that's working to address that issue.
First, President Trump delivered a wide-ranging 77-minute speech in Arizona last night. In the campaign-style speech, he rehashed his own statements on Charlottesville, renewed his hardline immigration stance, and attacked the media.
And back in the Capitol, the rift between the president and key members of the Republican Party continues to deepen. Reports say that the president and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell haven't spoken since an angry phone call earlier this month. You can share your thoughts on the president's Arizona speech, the Republican Party, and more at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ginger Gibson is a correspondent at Reuters, and she joins us to look at those stories and more in our weekly look at national politics. Ginger, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, President Trump gave a 77-minute, it was kind of a campaign-style speech in Arizona last night, and the governor of Arizona had asked him not to come. He came anyway. Tell us about the scene there and what struck you most about the speech.
You're right. Trump's speech raised a lot of eyebrows last night. It was pretty wide-ranging in topics, spent a good amount of time going after the press. But I think what was sort of maybe not surprising, but one of the most standout moments was while he didn't criticize the two senators from Arizona by name, joking that he promised his staff he would not do so, he did go after two Republican senators in their own state, including Jeff Flake, who's up for re-election in the next election cycle, and then tweeted the next morning criticism of Jeff Flake. So pretty unusual to see a president criticizing a member of his own party, just that, but also on his own turf in his own state.
And also interesting, he did not mention or send well wishes to Senator John McCain.
He did not mention him by name. You know, we know Senator John McCain is just, I believe, wrapping up a round of chemotherapy and radiation for cancer in his brain that was detected earlier this summer. It would not be unusual for someone, even of another party, to say, "Hope you're feeling better," and that didn't happen. Didn't say get well soon. Just sort of namelessly criticized him repeatedly for not voting for his Affordable Care Act repeal bill.
And apparently 15 minutes, I didn't run the timer, but I've read that 15 minutes were spent defending his comments on Charlottesville and that the president rehashed three of his statements and argued that he was unfairly criticized by the press for making controversial comments on race.
That's correct. He went on at length reading some of his previous statements, arguing that the media had unfairly portrayed what he had said. You know, the criticism of Trump on this front is that he's using dog whistles, that he's saying things in a way that one could look at it and say, well, he just criticized racist, but he then turns around and says it's a matter of both sides, which folks like David Duke or other white supremacist groups have praised as sort of Trump's way of winking and nodding. And that's what we've heard the criticism in the press. And Trump keeps trying to insist, like, that's not what's happening here. And they're just out to get me. Whereas, as we know, the release, if that's not the desired effect, it is the consequence of some of his remarks.
I hit him with neo-Nazi. I hit him with everything. I got the white supremacists, the neo-Nazi. I got them all in there, let's say. Yeah, KKK, we have KKK. I got them all. So they're having a hard time. So what did they say, right? It should have been sooner. He's a racist. It should have been sooner. Okay.
Ginger Gibson is with us right now from Reuters, and we're recapping the week's top stories in national politics, including the president's campaign-style speech in Arizona last night, and the president, again, getting into his comments on Charlottesville. And in response to all those events and the events on the ground in Charlottesville, there were protesters there last night, Ginger.
That's correct. We saw protesters outside. They clashed with the police. I mean, he is going into an area to hold this event that is a bit volatile. There are people who strongly disagree with him. It is not a decidedly red state or a decidedly red area where there's not going to be groups of political opposition. Arizona is a state that could very easily be won by a Democrat in the next Senate race or in the next presidential election. And so not surprised to see opponents. We also have to remember that his remarks about immigrants have been strongly criticized as being unfair, particularly towards Mexican-American immigrants. It is a state with a sizable Mexican-American population. So it's not just that population, but all the people who are their friends or their families or their neighbors who feel Trump is unfairly characterizing them and their role in the United States culture.
And in terms of another one of his campaign platforms, the border wall, that came up again last night.
It did. He has really rattled Wall Street today with his remarks last night about the border wall. He is insisting that the United States Congress give him money to begin building that wall. We can remember his campaign promise that Mexico was going to pay for the wall. That always seemed like a very unlikely proposition, since getting another sovereign nation to pay for border wall is going to be near impossible. Maybe there's a way, but not likely. And that's starting to catch up with Trump, who's now asking Congress to do what he calls a down payment to get the construction started. He made that call again last night, saying that he would shut the government down if they didn't give him funding for a wall. They only have 12 more working days in Congress when they return in the beginning of September to fund the government in order to prevent a government shutdown. And he really sort of rattled folks at the idea that he might force a government shutdown to try to get his border wall money.
And finally, Ginger, he made some allusions to, didn't say anything definitive, but made some allusions to his stance on a controversial figure in Arizona, Sheriff Arpaio.
That's correct. Sheriff Arpaio, who was a supporter of Trump, a very controversial figure who kept tent prisons in the very hot Arizona desert. He was convicted of racial discrimination in his policing. He's expected to be sentenced shortly, and Trump seemed to heavily suggest that he could give him a pardon and let him avoid that prison time. I have no doubt that if he were to do so, that would really upset particularly the people who have been the most critical of him in this last week for his response to Charlottesville, getting into something where someone has been, you know, convicted by a judge, in this case not a jury, but for engaging in some types of racial discrimination, would surely reinforce that criticism Trump has seen. And so that surprised a lot of people that he was so publicly stating that he's considering doing that.
And just before we move on, Ginger, I mean, President Trump presumably running again in 2020, but he just won an election less than a year ago. He's doing these campaign-style speeches in various places around the country. What do you see as the goal? Is it to keep the base energized? Is it to get support for his platform? What do you think, and is it working?
Yeah, Trump made an unusual move. And the day he took office, he filed for re-election. Normally, presidents in their first term wait until 2 years into their first term after the midterm elections to file for re-election. So Trump was actually holding a re-election rally. It wasn't even a campaign-like rally. It was, in fact, one of his re-election rallies. We don't normally see this from presidents and presidential candidates. They tend to wait. But that's the place where he feels maybe the most comfortable. It is a format where he feels like he can say wherever he wants. And we know that there are rules, there are constraints on what can be said at a government-organized or a government rally. President Obama often held sort of government-organized events where he was pushing for legislation. That's allowed. But engaging in politicking, saying who you should and shouldn't vote for, that is not allowed at a government-organized event. And I think Trump probably, or at least those around Trump, know it would be very difficult to constrain what he can and cannot say at such an event, and that he risks sort of crossing that line should they be government events.
Ginger Gibson is with us right now from Reuters as we take a look back at the week's top stories in national politics.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what you thought of the president's speech in Arizona last night. What did you think of the president's defense of his statements on the violence in Charlottesville? And tell us what you think of the president's relationship with other Republicans like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Do you think they can work together and get things done? If you're a Republican, are you worried about party unity? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're taking our weekly look at the latest in national politics with Ginger Gibson. She's a correspondent at Reuters.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you seeing a divide between the president and other key Republicans like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell? Is that something you're worried about? Do you think it'll make it hard to get stuff done with tax reform, debt ceiling, immigration, the border wall funding? Should the president keep pushing his immigration agenda? And do you think the Trump administration should be able to withhold funding from sanctuary cities? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Ginger, in his speech last night, the president also seemed to want to look at Congress, where Congress has stood with action. He's been critical of Congress, and here's what he said.
So I have a message for Congress tonight. Your job is to represent American families, American people, American workers. It's your job. You need to represent them on the border, on taxes, on health care, one vote, and on every other issue that affects their lives.
Emphasis on health care there, and it sounds as though, reading the tone and the comments, that the mood is souring between the president and Republicans in Congress.
It has been souring, I think, from day one. It is a struggle that President Trump is having in a very public manner, which is that even the president can't command a Congress controlled by his own party to do what they want when he wants it. It is much more complicated and difficult than that. We saw this feud sort of unfolding between President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. There have been critical words on both sides. And we saw again today some acknowledgement from McConnell that he will still work with the president, that he will meet with him likely when they return in September. So maybe a little bit of a thawing, but it's a tough one. And you know, I've covered governors that have no government background that get into office and they suddenly discover it's not like running a business where you can just tell everybody what to do and that they will immediately do it. That it is in legislative politics is a much more complicated endeavor. And I think we're watching in real time as Donald Trump learns those sometimes very difficult lessons.
And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and President Trump, they have very different political styles. It seems as though McConnell is very disciplined, discreet, plays his cards close to his vest, and it seems President Trump he's a straight shooter.
Yeah, you don't get to be a Senate Majority Leader without having a deep understanding of how politics work, how people work, how to broker deals, how to bring people together. He had to get most of his caucus to say that he was the best guy in the room, and that alone can be very difficult, especially you'd understand if you ever talk to a member of the United States Senate. Everyone thinks that they are the smartest, best guy or woman in the room. So it is a different type of skill. It's a different type of politicking. Donald Trump has risen to power largely by understanding marketing and branding and getting people to see him as a change agent, as someone who can do something different. A lot of what people are left scratching their heads, even after we watched him last night, why is he talking about a wall? Why is he talking about shutdown? Doesn't he understand he has to deal with these members of Congress? But that's not Donald Trump's skill. Donald Trump's skill is getting all those people excited whenever he says, yes, I'm going to build this wall. And so they do have very different styles, very different backgrounds, very different approaches to governing that I think we're seeing really sort of bear out in how they've struggled to get along with one another.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Ben on the line in Madison. Ben, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. So on a daily basis, NPR has sober, rational discussions about President Trump's agenda. And I appreciate your attempt to maintain a rational viewpoint on the president. I know NPR prides itself on that, and I think listeners appreciate it, that we're getting relatively unbiased conversation. The problem is you're talking about a sociopath. You're talking about someone who is unqualified to be president, and every single person who voted for him before the election knew that. 5-minute review of his public record, of his statements, the sexual harassment, the business, it goes on and on. So now you have this person who is leading the country, and you have all these people very confused about what's going on. We understand exactly what's going on. The president, as I said, is a sociopath and is completely incompetent for his job.
Ben, thanks for the call. And Ginger, Ben saying that, you know, there's no point having these kinds of conversations about the president. He thinks there's a larger conversation, elephant in the room, that the president is not suited, is not fit. Is that something that's picking up traction as you see it?
I think it's not picking up as much traction as much as he might like it to be. Those types of conversations are going to be very difficult. We have to remember Congress is controlled by Republicans. They still see maybe the possibility to get some of the things they want done, like tax reform, like cutting tax rates at a minimum, like repealing the Affordable Care Act. Those are still goals that he had. And I would make a pretty bold statement here, but Trump might have become the most predictable politician in Washington. These cycles that we've seen from him continue. Anyone who's been following closely for the last 2 years would not have been surprised by his speech last night in Arizona, or the fact that he got up today at the American Legion conference and gave a very sober, calm speech in front of that group. That's how he works. It should stop surprising people that he does surprising things sometimes.
Ben, thank you for the call. And next, we're gonna go to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'm not going to try to diagnose the president like the previous caller, but I would agree in the sense that he is an intellectually undisciplined president because of his lack of government experience and because he, you know, cannot stop talking about Charlottesville when any other rational player would have moved on from the subject. And I think what we should realize, reflects the previous caller's comments, it underscores how incredibly weak a candidate Hillary Clinton was. And the moral of the story is the Democratic Party should nominate people who are under federal investigation as their presidential nominee. And I say so as a registered Democrat. I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay, Jim, thanks for that. And Ginger, your thoughts?
You know, I think that you make an excellent point. We've already started to see a real serious discussion among Democrats, a real sort of soul-searching about how you oppose Donald Trump, what it is about him that voters liked or didn't like about Hillary Clinton, how much of each of those things was a factor. I think that this election cycle might be one of the longest we've had in a long time. We've already got Donald Trump declaring for re-election in January. We had our first Democratic challenger, a member of Congress, declare earlier this month. And I think we're going to continue to hear this conversation. And I think it is a real important discussion, not just for each party to have, but we as a country to ask ourselves, what do we want in our leaders and what is our priority? I think we're going to see that conversation going on for the next 3 years about what are our priorities and what's most important and what do we value in an elected official. And I think that there's going to be a lot of people who defend Hillary Clinton and say she was a great leader. She was informed. She was talking about. She had a great platform. She could talk about the issues. And others who are going to criticize her and say she wasn't a great candidate. And both of those folks are going to have a lot of factual points to make on their side of the debate.
And Ginger, moving on now, one of the biggest stories of the last week was former chief strategist Steve Bannon's departure from the White House after events in Charlottesville. And it seems as though he didn't miss a beat. He's right back in the saddle at Breitbart. What does it look like that relationship is going to be like now between the president and his former chief strategist?
That relationship already looks very strained. Bannon left the White House, went immediately back to Breitbart. There was a lot of speculating about what kind of role was he going to play. Was he going to be a megaphone for the president? Was he going to be providing sort of a cheerleading squad? And immediately within the first week, we see Breitbart criticizing President Trump's speech Monday night on Afghanistan in very harsh terms, suggesting that he had been bought into policies and positions that were not those that he campaigned on or that people voted him for. So not going to be a cheerleading squad coming out of Breitbart for the White House. Could be very critical. And it's going to be a relationship that I think is going to have to age over time. One of the important things to remember, though, that undecided voter who really tipped the election last November, probably not reading Breitbart. It's Trump's base that's reading Breitbart, and that's who he's talking to at these rallies, and that's who Bannon's been talking to for this time. And so it'll be interesting to see how that sort of push and pull plays out in the next few months.
And on to another story. Los Angeles is looking at joining the Sanctuary City lawsuit that, for instance, San Francisco and Chicago are a part of. Where does that stand now?
It's right. So we know that sanctuary cities are sort of cities across the U.S. That say that they won't participate in the federal immigration policies and that they would sort of be a place where you could be an illegal immigrant. And as long as you aren't doing anything really egregious, that they're not going to turn you over to the federal government. It's become a real point of contention. And there we've seen some of the move by the administration to sort of try to take money away from these sanctuary cities or try to force them to go along with some of the federal policies and the federal enforcement. And so we have a number of cities. This was a lawsuit with a group of California cities where they've said that that the administration can't force these jurisdictions by cutting off their funding or by creating funding conditions. This type of enforcement has a long history. It's how the federal government basically got all of the states to raise the drinking age to 21. We know that a number of states didn't want to do that. So it's worked before, and it's not worked before. In other cases, the courts have said you can't do that. So Los Angeles is a pretty big city to jump onto this, and it's also not an overwhelmingly blue city. It is a city that has to balance a lot of issues, a lot of different stakeholders, a lot of different people, unlike San Francisco, which was sort of leading this lawsuit to begin with. So it's another piece of evidence that cities and states probably in the future are willing to sort of fight the Obama administration on these types of moves. I mean, the Trump administration. Oh, goodness.
Ginger, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
That was Ginger Gibson, correspondent at Reuters, and she was with us there for our look at the week in Washington. Changes to the GED High School Equivalency Diploma Test in 2014 privatized the system and moved it online. And as a result, nationally, there was a drop from over 540,000 people taking the test in 2013 to only about 86,000 taking it in 2014.
And here in Wisconsin, there was a striking difference in how many people passed that test. In 2013, again, that's the last year of the old test, over 1,500 students passed at the four Milwaukee testing sites. In 2014, only about 130 passed.
One of those testing sites is the YWCA of Southeast Wisconsin, where over 400 students passed the test in 2013 and only two passed in 2014. As a result, they launched an innovative program to make the new test accessible and to support adult learners who want to achieve the goal of earning their high school equivalency diploma.
Jake Gerges has been the adult education manager at the YWCA Southeastern Wisconsin for 3 years. Over the past 10 years, Jake has worked in Milwaukee and helped over 1,000 students complete their GED and high school equivalency diploma. Jake, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Yolanda McMillan, recent graduate of the high school equivalency diploma adult learning program at the YWCA there. Yolanda, thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Jake, let's start with you. What changed in 2014 on how the GED worked?
Well, I think that there's a depth of knowledge issue that started in 2014. I kind of compare it to people using up all their computer RAM. First of all, they start out studying the material. Once they learn the material, they go into the test. The test ends up telling them to read several pages. And then they have to apply the past knowledge and the stuff that they just figured out or just read to a new problem or a new situation. And sometimes that's a lot to deal with in one setting.
And so what did you see with people coming in, training for the test, taking the test? What happened in 2014 that wasn't happening before?
Well, we had to establish new best practices, and we did that. We took our time. We established what it is people needed to do. And people were falling just short of the test, of passing the test. They were good students. They demonstrated it on other tests like the TABE test, but it didn't always really relate to success in the GED test.
I want to bring in Yolanda now before we talk about how you solved that at the YWCA. Yolanda, what led you to need to get this GED?
Okay, I was actually a contract worker working for the YWCA. I heard about the program, and in my past, I fought so hard trying to get this diploma. So with that being said, I entered the program, and it changed me as a whole, as a person. It learned my communication skills to go better. It also helped me get further in my career. I had degrees with child care and CBRS, but when you don't have your actual high school diploma, it puts you at a standstill. So as I entered the program, it changed me as a whole, as one as a person, and also as, you know, I'm able to go on and further my career being in the program.
So, Yolanda, it sounds like this training wasn't just here's how you pass the test. It did a lot more than that, right?
Yes, absolutely. It changed me as a person in whole. Like I said, it learned me how to better communicate, how to talk to people with the communication class that is provided at the school. And it was something that I was really struggling to do in my past. I always started and I was never able to complete it. So when I came here and I completed the program and I used the skills and abilities that was in the program, it has really changed my life. And in fact, right after I got my high school diploma, I was able to get a job. So I wasn't just a voluntary contract worker again. The high school diploma put me in a good paying position, better than I was working at first without it.
We're talking about a program in southeastern Wisconsin aimed at helping people pass the new version of the GED, that high school equivalency test. We're hearing there from Yolanda McMillan. She is a recent graduate of the program at the YWCA in southeastern Wisconsin. Also with us, Jake Gerges with the YWCA there, education, adult education manager. And Jake, what Yolanda was just talking about there, that's the goal of this exam. Again, it's not just a here's how to pass the exam. You're doing a lot more than that. Talk about what went into this program.
So the program was developed under a state code called 509. And what it is, it's actually like an adult high school. People come in, they do our 20-week program. It's broken down into three parts. It's in health, employability, and soft skills training. Then we have an 8-week section of math and science, and then there's a language arts and social studies component as well. And people demonstrate their skills similar to the way that people demonstrate skills in high school. They do coursework, they do projects, they do tests. And they need to demonstrate the competency of all the information at an 80% or higher. They also have to take the Wisconsin Civics exam and pass that at the same rate that every high school graduate does. But we also integrated in ACT's key trains and the Work Keys testing assessment, which is the National Career Ready testing, which is the Department of Workforce Development standardized test to show work readiness. So we are looking for individuals to come in without a high school diploma and leave with a high school equivalency diploma and a certificate that says that they're ready for work.
Right, and as I understand it, Jake, part of the material they work with might be an employee manual from a real work site, right? So that's part of what they're applying their critical thinking skills on.
Absolutely. It's contextualized learning. Although writing sonnets are good, not everyone's going to do that in the future, and most people aren't going to get paid for it. So we do need them to look at memos and case studies and different things like that they will come across in the workforce, because they're going to utilize that and they're going to apply it to their everyday life.
Now, Yolanda, I want to talk about just doing this class and getting through it. This is about 3 months long. Was it possible for you to juggle your life, your personal schedule, to make this happen?
Yes, it is, because you have to get up every day and you have to want to do it. It's something that you have to want to have, and anything worth having worth fighting for. So it was challenges. It was different days. Some days were hard and some days were not so hard. But to push through, that's the goal of life. You know, you have to push through to have finer things and to have education.
And Yolanda, are you encouraging other people that you know who might be in that situation, not having a high school degree? Would you encourage them to do this program that you did?
Yes, I will. In fact, I have. And I also encourage my son to follow my footsteps, because, you know, he didn't finish school. And so when you set an example, your kids will follow. So what I did was, instead of talking about it, I completed mine. And in fact, my son is going to enroll in the program, and he's going to continue to follow the footsteps that I followed so he can become a successful individual himself.
And Jake, talk about the numbers here. We started off talking about these big drops, you know, nationally in Wisconsin and at your site, and the number of people taking and then passing the GED exam since they changed it a few years back. Are you seeing that bounce back?
They lowered the standard, the passing score to 145, which was the area where most people were in that had just missed. So there is a bounce back happening. It's not at the numbers that it was before the test changed, but I don't think anyone thinks it's going to be that. The rigor of the test is greatly increased, and while it's not going to be the way that everyone gets it anymore, we still utilize it here, and that is a portion of what we do as well.
And Jake, since the test is harder to pass than it used to be, is this something that you think employers are going to look at and really take seriously when somebody applies and they've gotten this GED now?
I think that the GED is a little bit more difficult than what most entry-level workforce people will need. So I think that a GED does now mean a little bit more, and that was the purpose for the redesign. So I think, yes, the GED is no longer the good enough degree. It's a harder level now.
And Yolanda, as we wrap up, what impact would you say getting this equivalency degree and going through this program has had on you and your family?
It has a tremendous impact. In fact, like I said, I can go on and further my education, my skills and abilities, which I couldn't do before. I was set at a standstill. So it has encouraged and it has motivated my child, as I spoke, my 19-year-old son, to go on and finish his education and how important education to us is. Also, you know, I just touch the kids in the community that I see that may have backslided to let them know how important it is. And if they stay focused and they go through with the program, it'll be a success to them as well.
And Jake, working with people now for a few years at the YWCA on this, I mean, are you seeing a lot of success stories like Yolanda's?
Her story is not uncommon. Everyone has had struggles, and we always say that if life was perfect, we'd all be doctors and we'd all be on vacation. But people are working real hard, and they're overcoming some great obstacles. So it's really a great program, and this really helps the community.
Jake, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Yolanda, thank you, and good luck to you and your son. We've been talking to Yolanda McMillan, recent graduate of the High School Equivalency Diploma Adult Learning Program at the YWCA in southeastern Wisconsin, and Jake Gerges, Adult Education Manager at that YWCA southeastern Wisconsin. We want to hear from you about the best comedy movie of all time. The BBC released a list of the top 100 comedy films based on a survey of over 250 film critics around the world.
And now it's your turn. You can call us at 800-642-1234 with your favorite funny movie. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Number one on the list, and I'm going to have to admit this with some of these, I have not watched this movie in its entirety. I'm sorry, I'm getting looks here. Some Like It Hot with from Michelle there. Some Like It Hot with Marilyn Monroe, Tony Curtis, and Jack Lemmon.
You don't want me, sugar. I'm a liar and a phony, a saxophone player, one of those no good nicks you keep running away from.
I know, every time.
Sugar, do yourself a favor. Go back to where the millionaires are. The sweet end of the lollipop, not the coleslaw in the face, the old socks and the squeezed out tube of toothpaste.
Maybe not the funniest bit there, but it did have the bit about the saxophone player you need to run away from because he's a no good Nick.
You are a bit of a good no good Nick.
I get that a lot, yeah. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. I've seen little clips. I like to. Lately, I've been wanting to go on a bender and watch a bunch of old movies, but I just haven't had the time.
Yeah, and there's a lot. I mean, this runs, you know, from early 2000s. There's not super recent ones on the list, and it goes back to, you know, silent comedies, too. So it covers a lot of range, so I think there'll be a lot of things that people will agree with or argue about. Oh, we can go right to the callers. Ruthann is on the line in Madison. Ruthann, hi.
Good afternoon.
What movie did you want to suggest, Ruthann, for this list?
This might seem a little strange, but one of my all-time favorite comedies is Shrek.
Shrek, okay. And what is it? Are there lines that stick with you? Is this a movie you keep going back to again and again?
It's one of the few movies I've watched twice. I don't watch movies twice. It is hilarious. It's for all ages. The language is clean. And it's got a happy ending. And adults who haven't seen that movie have really missed out.
And who is your favorite character in that movie, Ruthann?
Well, I do like Shrek, but I like the donkey.
The donkey, me too. Yeah. See, I wanted to have a nice donkey moment with you. Yeah, he's really
That's
funny.
Eddie Murphy, right?
I think so. But he's also the voice of the dragon in Mulan, and he's hilarious in that, too. Another movie I like for many reasons, including Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, Eddie Murphy has had, I mean, he's been in a lot of comedies. One was on the list, actually, Trading Places, was on the BBC list. He has had a second act in animated movies as well. So thank you so much for starting us off, Ruthann. Appreciate it.
And we're going to go next to Art joining us in Rhinelander. Art, hello.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. What do you vote for?
I'm voting for Young Frankenstein.
Young Frankenstein. Okay, what do you like about that one?
Well, I think it's got a phenomenal cast, incredibly well written, and so totally original in its approach. And it just, I don't know, it's got so many punchlines that it seems like every other minute or 30 seconds you're laughing because of a... But the cast is incredible as well, with Gene Wilder and Forrest Leachman, and I mean, like, it just goes on.
Madeline Kahn.
Marty Feldman.
Yeah. I've got one correction, though, Art. Isn't it pronounced Frankenstein?
that's right. Yes. Young Frankenstein.
By the way, Art, that was number 22 on the BBC list. And Blazing Saddles, also by Mel Brooks, was right in that neighborhood, too, in the 20-ish zone. So thank you so much for calling in. We're taking your top 100 comedy movies of all time, or your... Maybe one favorite. The BBC just put out a list of their top 100 based on a survey of film critics.
Yeah, some of it we thought, well, is this really a comedy?
Yeah.
Like Pulp Fiction. I think it's debatable whether that's a comedy. Because if that's a comedy, I would list one of my favorite movies of all time, Smoke Signals, which is really funny, but it's also really poignant. Yeah, sometimes they walk the line.
Yeah, there were a few in there that, you know, Princess Bride is funny, but it's a romance, it's a fairy tale.
Yeah.
I mean, I like it, and we've interviewed Cary Elwes on the show. But is it like a ha-ha comedy?
Is it a comedy? Right.
Well, before we go back to your calls, number two on the list after Some Like It Hot, one I have seen, Dr. Strangelove. And here's Peter Sellers. He's playing three different roles. But here he's the president of the United States on the phone with the drunken premier of the Soviet Union, sharing a little bit of bad news.
Well, now, what happened is one of our base commanders, he had a sort of, well, he went a little funny in the head, you know. Just a little funny. And he went and did a silly thing. Well, I'll tell you what he did. He ordered his planes to attack your country. Well, let me finish, Dmitri. Let me finish, Dmitri. Well, listen, how do you think I feel about it?
So, I mean, like almost all that movie, it's simultaneously funny and bone-chilling.
I'd forgotten that movie, and now it's all coming back. Yeah, that's a good one.
A lot of moments like that in Dr. Strangelove.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Mike joining us next in Lodi. Mike, hi.
Oh, my goodness, I'm on. Hi.
Yes, you are. What do you want to say?
I've got an old gem for you. It's called Kings of the Road by Wim Wenders. It's an old Wim Wenders film, and it's a road film. About a projection repairman who meets a fellow who's suicidal, and he tries to drive his VW into the Danube, but it wouldn't sink, you know, because they float, you know. So he rescues him, and they begin the road story.
Nice.
And it turns into a comedy there. The setup doesn't sound comedic, but it gets funny.
Well, sure, when you see a Volkswagen sort of skipping across the Danube and he's trying to kill himself, but he sits there and floats. Yeah, it's kind of like, it's funny. It's kind of like Dr. Strangelove.
Uh-huh, I gotcha.
You know, it's kind of,
funny and uncomfortable at the same time. I get you. Thanks. That's one I've seen some Wim Wenders films. That is not one I'd heard of, actually.
Nor I, but it's bringing, for some reason it brought back I Love You to Death. Did you ever see that movie?
I did.
River Phoenix is in it. They try
Kevin
to
Klein.
Kill Kevin Klein.
Tracy Ullman?
Yeah, Tracy Ullman. And it probably would not be funny now, but I remember thinking it was hilarious when I saw it.
Yeah, there's a lot of comedies I wonder if I should go back and watch again, if they'd still hold up. Hey, back to your calls with the best comedy movies of all time. Chris with us in Baraboo. Chris, hi.
Oh, hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you got for us, Chris?
I said Dumb and Dumber, which apparently did not make the list, but I thought that was a great one. Jim Carrey was always just such a funny guy to me.
Yeah, and that's, a lot of people love that movie, and it was Jim Carrey and the guy from Chelsea, Michigan.
Daniels.
Jeff Daniels.
Daniels, thank you. Yeah, he grew up not far from where I grew up in Michigan, so he's kind of a local hero there. But yeah, that is a very popular one. It didn't make the list, but it has gotten a lot of laughs from people.
What was the first Jim Carrey breakout movie?
Let's see, not lie to me. The Mask?
Ace Ventura. Yeah, I like that. For my Jim Carrey money, I'm going to go with that one.
Chris, thanks a lot for calling. Janet is with us next in Friendship. Janet, hi.
Hi.
What's your movie to recommend?
A Fish Called Wanda with Jamie Lee Curtis and John Cleese and Kevin Klein.
And Michael Palin, too, also from Monty Python, he and John Cleese. That was number 36 on the BBC list. Have you watched it lately? Is this one you come back to?
Oh, yeah. I own it on a DVD, and I'm a rewatcher.
Okay.
The other one that is not as clever but also stars Jamie Lee Curtis is True Lies, and it's a spoof on the spy movies, and it's with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
And I get a kick out of that because it takes them forever to kill the bad guys. They have to kill them 6-7 times, you know.
Thank you so much for calling and sharing those movies. Janet, Fish Called Wanda on the list. True Lies, I don't think was, though.
I don't think so, no. But here's one that was on the list. Maybe it needs no introduction, but here's one anyway. Spinal Tap.
This is a top to, you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
and then amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it?
Yeah, anybody in a band has heard many a Spinal Tap reference over the years. So I think we get another caller or two in. Dylan with us in Platteville. Dylan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I definitely got to say Pineapple Express is one of my favorite comedies. I'm not sure if it's on your list or not, though.
It wasn't on the BBC list, but that is one I thought of when I was thinking of ones that I've really enjoyed that weren't on the list. It was James Franco and Seth Rogen, right?
I haven't seen it. Why should I see that one, Dylan?
Why should I see that? Just the dialogue. I mean, it's an action movie with comedy, but it's just all simple dialogue, just sitting around. And it reminds you of, like, you know, a good buddy you had.
Dylan, thanks so much.
Nice.
Parental advisory, drug references, strong language, and lots of shooting.
Gotcha. All right. Well, it sounds like a nice maybe date night or something kind of movie. All right, Dylan, thanks for that. We go next to Keith in Leona. Keith, hi.
Hi. Here's one that perhaps many of your listeners have not heard of. This goes back to 1962 or so. It's a Billy Wilder movie, Irma La Douce, with Shirley MacLaine and Jack Lemmon.
Okay.
I'm stumped. I don't know anything about that
one. Yeah, that one is new to me. We're just about out of time. Keith, thank you so much for sharing that one. A couple Billy Wilder ones on the list. Also on the line, we don't have time, I see Uncle Buck, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, some John Candy lovers out there, Caddyshack, all good movies too.
Nice. And Tootsie. I would have put Tootsie on the list for sure. We rewatched that so many times when I was a kid. That was a good one. And also Back to the Future. That was a really funny
movie.
Oh,
yeah, that was... Oh,
with Crispin Glover.
I've got to go dig that up.
I think it was.
Well, thank you so much for your calls. You can check out that whole list of comedy movies from the BBC, and you can also share yours over on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Speaking of funny movies, here is one that we missed. Ghostbusters, a lot of favorite lines. This is one, you're more prone to quote this one than I am, I think.
I saw this a lot. I think I was bored. We lived in some pretty small towns when I was growing up. But yeah, I still say, you know, when someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes.
And then, of course, it's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, the entity, the incarnation of evil that attacks the city.
And, of course... Come in, Ray. Very simple, but you can say it in almost any situation.
Right. And of course, one that comes up, I think, a lot is the whole dogs and cats living
together
in the description.
Mass hysteria.
Yeah. A lot of good quotable moments from that. Here's one moment in Ghostbusters.
Batman, what happened? Are you okay?
He slimed me.
That's great. Actual physical contact. Can you move?
Ray, come in, please.
I feel so funky. Spengler, I'm with Bankman. Oh, you got slime.
That's great, Ray. Save some for me.
I understand that Bill Murray only did the sequel on the condition that he would not be slimed in the movie. There's a scene where he splits up with the other ones.
That's
they
fair.
Get slimed. He does not.
And you actually liked the second Ghostbusters. Well, is it the second or is it?
Well, the newer incarnation.
The newer incarnation.
The female leads. Mm-hmm. I laugh out loud funny if I think I was going to watch them back to back. I think I laugh more. Some people will be angry at the newer one.
The newer one.
Yeah.
Okay, it's kind of heresy, but I haven't seen the newer one, so I'm going to suspend judgment. You can let us know about your favorites over on the Central Time Facebook page. Something strange.